From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. A half century ago, an American president hired five burglars to break into the offices of his political opponents. That, of course, was the beginning of the Watergate scandal. And following that, Congress created a new kind of watchdog, the Inspector General. Today, there are more than 70 of them spread out across the federal bureaucracy. But within the last 2 months, President Trump has removed five of them and replaced them sometimes with people the Inspector General's offices are meant to investigate. So this hour on Point, the president's purge of the Inspectors General, why he's doing it, and what it means for basic oversight and accountability in the federal government. And we're going to begin today with a firsthand account of what it's like to work in an OIG. Joel Brenner joins us. He served as Inspector General for the National Security Agency from 2002 to 2006. He then served as head of U.S. counterintelligence under the Director of National Intelligence. Today, he's a senior research fellow at MIT Center for International Studies and also author of Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World. Joel Brenner, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. It's great to be back with you.
It's good to have you on the show again. So, first of all, allow me a moment here to just bullet point the five inspector generals or acting inspector generals who have been removed from their offices in the past couple of months. First, on Friday, April 3rd, we had Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson being fired by the president. Within a week of that, Acting Defense Department Inspector General Glenn Fine was removed from his post. Then on May 2nd, the president announced that he would be replacing Christy Grimm, who was filling the top role at the Inspector General's office in an acting capacity at Health and Human Services. And then on May 15th, the president announced he would be removing State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick. And then on that same Friday night, Acting Inspector General for the Department of Transportation, Mitch Baim, was replaced by the president, by the president's another pick from President Donald Trump. So that's the list. Joel Brenner, have we ever seen anything like it?
No, never. Nothing coming close. We've seen IGs removed, but in general, there's been a kind of norm that presidents of both parties have observed that you leave IGs in place unless there's some good cause to remove them. That's not the law, by the way, but that's been the norm. And this president doesn't really have much respect for that kind of norm. And he has exercised his removal power to the nth degree. And he has removed officials he doesn't like. Not only have we seen that before, but we've never seen any IG removed in the course of investigating either the president or cabinet official or one of the president's main programs. It's not happened.
Well, when you served as Inspector General at NSA, that was under the administration of President George W. Bush for much of that. Did you ever have a concern that the activities or investigations you were undertaking at NSA could lead you to be removed by the president?
Yes. It didn't happen, but I was the first Inspector General at NSA actually to audit collection of SIGINT, that's to say electronic communications. And that happened during the Stellar Wind period when President Bush issued that now famous order that he was going to collect certain widespread metadata and communications between terrorists overseas and anybody in the United States. And that we do that now, but we do it under statute. And the president, and particularly the Vice President Cheney, didn't like that statute, the FISA statute, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So Bush set up a series of orders that I thought were all wrong and said so at the time, but I decided that if it was going to be done, I wanted to make sure it was not abused for political purposes. And so I began to audit that program, and I began to ask certain questions about that program, and the vice president's office didn't like that one bit. And I remember getting screamed at in the at the Justice Department one day by David Addington, who was basically, I could say, Obama's henchman. He was his at that time chief of staff. And you know, I came there to deliver a message, and I delivered it anyway. But if you have that kind of job, Meghna, you're not really independent unless you can make a living doing something else. And I could. I could have gone back to private law practice. So I said what I had to say, and nothing happened. Well, I think because the administration maybe realized that what I was doing made a lot of sense.
Well, when you got screamed at by Addington, what was he telling you? What was he screaming?
Oh, he was screaming that the President of the United States wants to do this. He wants to do it exactly as the order was written, and I knew Addington had written the order, and it had some serious legal issues with it. He didn't really understand how collection went, and I should just shut up and go home. And the last thing he was going to do was show me the opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel that underpinned that order, which I demanded to see. And so he was literally sort of levitating out of his chair. He's a big guy, and he's a bully. But I just said what I had to say, and that was that. Nothing happened. But, you know, it was a case where if you have that kind of job, you have to know where your lines are. And here is what I will do. And if they don't like it, they can, well, you just have to get somebody else to do the job because I'm going to do it the way I think it should be done. And that's, most IGs are like that. But particularly if you get an IG from the outside rather than somebody who's going to have to go back into the bureaucracy and make his living pleasing the people he's supposed to be investigating.
Okay. And just as a quick correction, Joel, I think you said Addington was President Obama's henchman, but I presume since you meant Vice President Cheney.
Gosh. Oh, gosh, yes, that's right. He was Cheney's chief of staff and then his counsel. That's right. Big mistake. Yeah. Thank you.
That's all right. So to your point about the required independence that an inspector general must have, even when they must go toe-to-toe with the administration, do you think that the president's recent actions with these five inspectors general has that shaken the IG community? Are people feeling concerned about the independence in offices around the federal bureaucracy?
Oh, yes. I think this has been clear since the Atkinson firing, which was the first of the five that you mentioned in setting up the piece. I think every IG and every acting IG now knows that if he or she does the job and crosses the administration, that there's a high risk of being fired, and that cannot help but chill the work. It doesn't mean it won't get done, but somebody's going to have to either decide, I really like this job so much, maybe I'll trim my sails, or that, okay, I tightened my gut and I'm going to do it anyway, but I better start looking for another job. Not how it's supposed to work, but that's how it's working under this president.
Mm. Well, can you tell us a little bit more about how it's supposed to work within the offices of the inspectors general? Because are they insulated technically by the IG law, or because you said earlier it's not necessary, they're not necessarily protected by law, but by norms.
By norm and custom. Yeah, the protections have been good so far, up to recently. I was also saying, Meghna, that there are two kinds of independence. There's statutory independence, and the statute here specifies that the IGs will be appointed without regard to political affiliation and solely on the basis of integrity and demonstrated ability in law or auditing or something like that. There's that kind of independence, which we've now seen is kind of shaky. And there's the other kind of independence, which is if you need the job because your mortgage is, you're over your head financially, you're paying school tuition and this and that or the other thing, then you're not really independent anyway. And that's why it's very important that IGs come from the outside and can go back and make a living on the outside. But that's not the law at all. I know I was lucky when I was at NSA. I was working for General Hayden and then General Alexander, and I made clear to them that I would do the job the way I saw fit. And when they got tired of hearing me, they could let me know, and I go back to practicing law. And they, by and large, entirely supported what I was doing. But that's not the case with these five that you mentioned.
Mm. Specifically, we have, I think, in one case, if I can keep all the IGs straight, the person that the president has picked to replace the acting IG in the Department of Transportation is from within the department itself.
Yeah, that's a real mistake. If you want an IG who's going to do his job, and that's the way it used to be at NSA before the middle of the 1990s. When there was always some insider who got the job and then had to go back into the bureaucracy. And that's a recipe for somebody who's going to pull punches. You know, you have to go back and work in the bureaucracy that you're supposed to be overseeing. It's not a good recipe for finding out what you want to find out, if you want to find out anything. And I think this president doesn't. You know, when you set this piece up, you did it very nicely in that you explained to people that the president has the right to remove, that's the fancy legal word for fire, any appointee. He just has that right. And so now the question is, can the Congress insert a good cause provision that doesn't exist now in the statute?
Right. And then the other question is, we've never had a president who's exercising that right to the extent that President Trump is. And what is the impact of that on the concept of accountability in the federal bureaucracy? So, Joel Brenner, stand by for a second. We might try to dial you back to see if we can get a better line with you as well. But we'll bring in a couple of other voices on the other side of this break. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about President Trump's decision to sweep out five inspectors general, some of them acting inspectors general, in the past couple of months. What it means, why he's doing it, and what impact that has on accountability, on oversight, on our democracy. And I'm joined today by Joel Brenner. He is the former Inspector General for the National Security Agency. He served in that position from 2002 to 2006. He's currently a research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. And joining us now from Washington is Norm Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and an expert on Congress and U.S. politics and co-author of many books, but most relevantly to this conversation, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Norm Ornstein, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
And also with us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Charles Sykes. He's a conservative political commentator and editor-in-chief of The Bulwark and host of The Bulwark podcast, author of many books, including A Nation of Moochers, Dumbing Down Our Kids, and How the Right Lost Its Mind. Charles Sykes, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
So I want to just play a couple of clips from the president and members of his cabinet in response to the firing of these inspectors general. First of all, here is what President Trump said after he let Inspector General Michael Atkinson go late on the first Friday in April. And here's what the president told reporters who asked him why.
Why did you decide to turn?
I thought he did a terrible job. Absolutely terrible. He took a whistleblower report, which turned out to be a fake report. It was fake. It was totally wrong. It was about my conversation with the president of Ukraine. He took a fake report and he brought it to Congress. with an emergency, okay? Not a big Trump fan, that I can tell you.
That was the president after the first Friday in April. And just to fact check, the contents of that whistleblower report was not fake and was in fact verified in public testimony by the most senior level diplomats serving in the United States government who testified before Congress. Now, here is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, because the president fired State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick a couple of Fridays ago. Mike Pompeo, or Secretary Pompeo, had said that he'd lost confidence in him, and some Republican senators wanted more detail on that. One of them, Senator Chuck Grassley, said, "Lost confidence without further explanation is not sufficient." And here is Secretary Pompeo responding to that at a press briefing the following week.
The president has the unilateral right to choose who he wants to be his inspector general at every agency in the federal government. They are presidentially confirmed positions, and those persons, just like all of us, serve at the pleasure of the president of the United States. In this case, I recommended to the president that Steve Linnick be terminated. Frankly, should have done it some time ago.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Charlie Sykes, first of all, respond to the basic assertion that the president and the Secretary of State are making there, that it's simply his right, so no big deal.
Well, it is legally his right. There's no question about it, but it is a big deal because the larger picture here is the assault on accountability. And it was seemed like 5 minutes ago that Republicans in the United States Senate understood that, including my home state, Senator Ron Johnson, who really pushed for the Inspector General Empowerment Act, because they understood the importance of independent watchdogs who would hold these agencies accountable. And this was the way that the inspector generals played a crucial role in informing Congress and the American public of what was going on. So, yes, the president technically does have the ability to fire those individuals. But I do think that there's something fundamental here that people need to understand, that whether you're talking about the attack on whistleblowers, the attack on the media, what's going on with the Department of Justice, we are seeing a wholesale assault on the principle of accountability. And I know that Norm's going to get into this in more detail. And while Congress sits by and abdicates its own responsibilities of oversight as well.
So, Norm, it seems to me that as Charlie's saying, the biggest concern here is something you've been talking about and writing about for a long time, that when the goalposts get permanently moved, what we're talking about are fundamental changes to accountability, to even the concept of oversight in the United States government, regardless of who is in the White House. It just happens to be President Trump that has exploited perhaps the weaknesses in the IG statute most effectively thus far. So are you seeing a permanent change in the norms here?
I'm very worried about that. But let me go back for just 1 second. Charlie is right, and we're all right, that he has the legal right to do this. We need to point out that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has acted, however, in a lawless fashion, because the law says that while a president can fire an inspector general, that has to be with 30 days notice. What Mike Pompeo did was to lock out the inspector general, who was investigating his misbehavior immediately after he was fired. That's illegal, period. So we're not just looking at applying the law in ways that violate all of the norms. We're looking at something worse than that. And putting in place a number of acting inspectors general, beyond the five that we're talking about, in some instances refusing to nominate anybody for a position, and putting in acting IGs who then go for much longer than the law allows under the Vacancies Act. So we're looking at more than norm violations here. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there are real norm violations. And I come back often to an article written by my late mentor, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, called Defining Deviancy Down. And once you start to move away from these norms, you get a new normal. And what I see at this point is that the larger set of issues, the assumption built into the Inspector General Act and so many others, including emergency decrees for presidents, that a president is going to be acting in a rational fashion in regard to the interests of the American people and not his own interests. We can't hold to that anymore. And we're going to have to go back and look at a lot of these laws and make changes because Donald Trump has shredded the way in which they were supposed to behave as a president who's unlike any we've seen.
And he has been allowed to shred them, though, Norm, isn't that
by Congress?
Yes. That's because who's supposed to hold the executive to account? It's supposed to be Congress.
So Charles Grassley, who has long been a defender of and supporter of inspectors general, harshly criticized President Obama at different times while saying that he's troubled, has done nothing. And one of the things that really struck me, we just had a confirmation of a new director of national intelligence who had his nomination initially withdrawn because he lied about his own credentials and didn't meet the statutory requirements for that position, was renominated. And the Intelligence Committee in the Senate basically pushed out his nomination on an 8-7 vote with all the Republicans voting in favor. If any one of them had said, I'm not going to vote for this nominee or any others the president wants until he does something about inspectors general, if any three Republican senators said, we're not going to let this go forward, if the Senate itself did serious oversight hearings on all of these things, we would probably be in a different position. And that is a core part of the problem here.
Joel Brenner, since Norm mentioned John Ratcliffe as the new director of national intelligence, just you want to chime in on that? Your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't think that it's welcomed in the bureaucracy, although that's, of course, legally irrelevant. But we have a man now who isn't qualified to hold that job. And he's close to the president. He doesn't begin to have the experience with how the intelligence business works to know how to run it. He's there because he's holding a place so that nobody in that intelligence business can do something the president doesn't like. Norm and Charlie are just right about this. Mm.
So Charlie Seitz, let's just get down to the fundamental question here. What is at stake when Congress abdicates its willingness to push back against the president, and we lose the levers or begin to lose the levers of accountability? What is at stake?
Well, I think the question answers itself. What you have here is the fundamental constitutional balance, the separation of powers, the co-equal branches of government. And the founding fathers actually believed that ambition would counter ambition. They couldn't imagine the United States Senate, the Congress of the United States, essentially saying, we're willing to be potted plants. We're willing to allow the president of the United States to blind us, to block us from any sort of accountability. They just didn't imagine that would happen, which is why they created the system. So Norm is absolutely right. You know, once you begin to define deviancy down, it becomes very difficult to go back. And I think one of the things that we've learned over the last couple of years is that much of this these constitutional norms were based on an honor system, that they were not, you know, hard and fast written in stone, that there was an assumption that the man or woman who sat in the Oval Office would be at some level an honorable person and who would honor some of the traditions and some of the prerogatives of the other branches of government. And now what we are discovering is that, well, what happens when you have a dishonorable man, someone who does not respect sort of constitutional balance, does not want transparency, does not want watchdogs looking at what he is doing, wants to intimidate whistleblowers. And what we're finding out is that the system really does not, is much more fragile, is much thinner than I think that we imagine. So what is at stake here is really whether or not we are going to have a government that that works the way that I think a lot of us assumed that it would. And the inspector generals is a huge story in and of itself. And by the way, I'm really glad that Norm pointed out the way that the president is violating the law and the Senate is doing nothing about that, because that is absolutely true. But I also think that we need to see the attack on the inspector generals as part of this larger question of, does the government serve the public? Is Congress going to actually hold the executive branch accountable? And is the American public going to be able to find out what its own government is doing, especially at a time when the responsibilities are so vast and the consequences of the failure are so dire.
But we must put a fine point on this, because what we're talking about right now, when we say Congress writ large, we're talking about Republican members of Congress, aren't we? I mean, specifically in the Senate, Charlie.
Yes, yes, very much so. And this is a remarkable phenomenon, and it is an historic phenomenon, because I mentioned Ron Johnson, who's the chairman of the Government Oversight Committee in the United States Senate. When Barack Obama was the president, he was a zealous advocate for this kind of oversight, very, very strong supporter of empowering the inspector generals and protecting them against political interference. And to watch how the Republicans in the Senate have capitulated is an ongoing, extraordinary story. And I have to say, from my point of view, deeply disillusioning, because I thought that there would be a little bit of an independent streak. You can accuse me of naivete. But what's happened now is that one Republican after another has basically decided, whatever, we're all in with Donald Trump. The only standard of behavior seems to be, does it help Trump or does it hurt Trump? And the consequences going forward for the functioning of government is really extraordinary, because when Donald Trump leaves office, this damage is not going to go away. We're not going to snap back to some, perfect system, because this tradition and this mindset is really quite extraordinary and depressing.
Yeah. Norm, go ahead.
Traditions are hard to establish and easy to break. And what we're seeing now is an assault on the political culture. And
yes,
that is not going to be easily undone. The next guy coming in is going to have to decide what to do with IGs. Once this has been beaten up, it's going to stay that way. Mm.
So let me just note a couple of things first. Why were these inspectors general fired? We know you mentioned the intelligence case, which was an inspector general who did what the law required him to do.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the inspector general at HHS was let go because this was an inspector general looking into how they'd handled the pandemic and not in ways that were going to be flattering to the administration. The State Department, Mike Pompeo, let this person or required that this person be fired and wouldn't let him back in because he was investigating Pompeo's alleged misuse of staff to do personal errands for himself and his wife, and tried to get around Congress in providing arms to Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of the brutal torture and murder of an American resident, Khashoggi. The Department of Transportation Inspector General let go because that Inspector General was investigating the Department Secretary, Elaine Chao, married to Mitch McConnell, sending contracts and other goodies to Kentucky to help her husband. So we're talking about things done for all the wrong reasons. And it's very clear to me that while I was involved in trying to come up with an alternative to the independent counsel statute in the aftermath of what happened with Bill Clinton and many of the people involved there, Ken Starr and others. You can have inspectors or counsel who can range out of control. You need to find a different way of checking and balancing and having independent investigations of alleged wrongdoing without having a power that's too great. The balance here is off. And what we need is a complete overhaul of this law that has inspectors general appointed not by the president or picked not by the president, confirmed ultimately by the Senate, but by an independent group, I think perhaps consisting of former inspectors general, and no way to have temporary ones that last for any length of time without having replacements picked again by an independent group. And firing for cause with specifics mentioned and the ability and the necessity of Congress looking into that. There are better ways of doing this, and we can no longer rely on assumptions that presidents are going to follow the norms and traditions or be uncorrupt.
So, Norm, we've got less than 60 seconds before we have to take our next break. point taken on how the law ought to be reformed, but the very members of Congress that would have to enact that law are the ones who are enabling the president's behavior right now.
Well, the Republicans in the Senate, if they have a majority, if Joe Biden is president, will jump to reform all kinds of laws to put constraints on the president. I am convinced of that.
Well, Norm Ornstein, Charlie Sykes, and Joel Brenner, stand by for just a second. We are talking about President Trump's sweeping away of five inspectors general, some of them acting inspectors general, and this big question that we're wrestling with about what that means for accountability, for oversight on behalf of the American people of the federal government. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to be talking about the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It was once one of the most celebrated public health agencies anywhere in the world. What is your impression of the CDC now? It's been largely quiet or pushed to the background in the nation's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. What do you want to know about the CDC's history, its structure, its mission, and its internal workings in the past couple of years? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We'll be taking a look at what's happened to the CDC on tomorrow's show. But today, we are talking about President Trump's sweeping away of five inspectors general in the past couple of months. And joining us to help talk through that is Charlie Sykes. He is editor-in-chief of The Bulwark and host of the Bulwark podcast. Norm Ornstein is also with us. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And Joel Brenner joins us as well. He's the former inspector general for the NSA and now a research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. And Joel, what I wanted to do, I'm wondering if you could help me out here a little bit, is I want to do kind of a little lightning round with you about other firings or replacements of inspectors general in the past. And the reason why I wanted to do that is because there's some reporting from Fox News that's been making the rounds saying, well, President Obama also let a lot of IGs go. And if we could just quickly go through the list that Fox has. Can you just check us on each one of these, Joel, okay?
Sure.
So first of all, Gerald Wolpin, he was President Obama actually did fire him as inspector general, right?
That's correct. He did. And he fired them after Wolpin referred a matter to the U.S. attorney in California, who actually brought a case and settled that case with involving $400,000 coming back to the government. Obama gave an explanation relating to Walpin's instability, which looked like a serious explanation. But one might have said that the person involved in California got off easy, but that's the only one that Obama fired, and he seemed to have a good reason for it.
Okay, so that was Wolpin. What about Fred Weiderhold, Amtrak Inspector General?
Well, Amtrak is not part of the executive branch of the government. Obama didn't hire that IG and didn't fire that IG. He was appointed by the CEO of Amtrak, and he was fired by the CEO of Amtrak. Obama had nothing to do with it.
Judith Gwynne, acting IG for the U.S. International Trade Commission?
exactly the same story. Obama didn't appoint her and didn't fire her. There's no indication that anybody in the White House had anything to do with that firing. And once again, I want to emphasize that there are these lower-ranking IGs spread around the government that aren't necessarily part of the executive branch. This is a red herring here.
Neil Barofsky, who was special IG for the Wall Street bailout.
He wasn't fired at all. He had an issue relating to what was the scope of his responsibility as outlined in the Wall Street bailout legislation, and he raised that issue, but he wasn't fired.
He wasn't fired? He just, was his scope reduced? I mean, is that a...
Yeah, he wanted a bigger job than the Congress gave him, and he wasn't fired, period.
Okay. Patrick McFarland, IG of the Office of Management and Budget.
Well, somebody apparently at OMB told him that if he complained about certain things, they were going to make life miserable for him. If somebody had told me that when I was the IG, that's exactly what I would have started looking at. But he wasn't fired at all. He just simply not fired.
And Michael Horowitz, former IG at the Department of Justice.
Also not fired. He's still the IG at the Department of Justice. In the course of investigating the Fast and Furious scandal, which involved guns going south of the border with Mexico, he asked the FBI for some documents. The FBI invoked the national security exception in the IG bill for refusing to give it to him. One could be skeptical about whether that was the IG was on strong legal grounds there, but he wasn't fired. It's simply a red herring. So of the six, we have the one we know about, two that were fired that were lower ranking that the White House had nothing to do with, and three of the six who weren't fired at all.
Hmm. And so not former, as you pointed out, Joel. Thank you for that. So the reason why I wanted to go through that lightning round, Norm and Charlie, is that, as you well know, those are the names that the supporters of the president are pointing to, saying he is acting per usual in terms of the scope and power of a president's ability to change inspector generals at his whim. I mean, Charlie, obviously you don't buy that.
Well, it's really helpful that you go through all of that because, of course, this is the fallback position on the part of a lot of folks on the right, particularly the right media, which is to engage in whataboutism. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you immediately pivot to let's not talk about what Donald Trump is doing, why he's doing it, the underlying corruption that may be covered up here. Let's just talk about Obama. So that would be the go-to excuse. And in fact, as you just rather graphically illustrated, there's really nothing there. Could I just go back to a point I'm really glad that Joel raised a little bit earlier?
Yes.
You know, we're talking in terms of abstractions about accountability and about whistleblowers. I think the really distinctive part about what we've been talking about here is that there are underlying problems. Actually, that understates it as well. There's underlying corruption and misconduct going on in this administration that is not normal. That a lot of the things that the whistleblowers are trying to bring to the public attention or that the inspector generals are looking at is a kind of grift that seems kind of distinctive in the kleptocracy that we have right now, so that it's not just simply business as usual here. In each one of these cases, there was underlying misconduct, things that the public had every right to know about. And also, I think that going forward, the ability of the inspector generals to look at political pressure, cover-ups, misinformation, the way the government handled or mishandled something like the coronavirus pandemic becomes incredibly important. So the underlying issues are as important as what's been done to eliminate the accountability.
Well, and so then, Norm, I keep coming back to this because I just don't know any other way to look at it. Per Charlie's point, by normalizing or excusing or not holding the executive to account, are not the Republican members of Congress we've been talking about also normalizing corruption in the federal government of the United States?
I think there's no question about that. And You know, when the framers set up the system, they were well aware that we could end up with a president who was inherently corrupt, autocratic, and unfit for office. That could happen, and so they had checks and balances built in. The number one check and balance was a Congress that had power and the ability to put restraints around presidential behavior. The second was an independent judiciary. And neither of those is working very well right now. We'll see further tests ahead for the judiciary. The fact is, we have not had a president in our history, I believe, who had the level of corruption in his own personal behavior, with his family, with all the people in his administration, including most of those in the cabinet, that had a level of corruption anywhere close to this. You could go back to Warren Harding. You could go to Ulysses S. Grant with people in his own administration. You could deal with issues like Iran-Contra, some of the things surrounding Bill Clinton. They were nothing compared to what we have now. And that Congress, and that Republicans in Congress, and that's the important distinction here, a party that I believe, to be blunt, has become more like a cult than a traditional political party, have failed to put those restraints on, will ultimately come back to bite them. But along the way, we're suffering a lot of damage as well. And it's a tragedy. And it's a tragedy because we need two functioning, problem-solving, honest political parties. Without that, the whole system careens out of control.
Hmm. Joel Brenner, ultimately, in a functioning democracy, to Norm's point, ideally, the ultimate lever of accountability is the lever in the ballot box. Right.
That's right. That's right.
So people can say, here's what I care about and here's how I'm casting my vote. I do wonder if the corruption that Norm and Charlie are pointing to, I wonder if Americans actually care about it. What do you think?
You know, well, I some do, a lot don't. You know, politics is a passion for some people, a profession for other people, and a bother for an awful lot of citizens. I think that the question you ask, the answer to the question you ask, will be clearer in November. And what one is really aiming at is that middle of the electorate that isn't totally tied to one party or the other, that is persuadable. And that is the group of people who need to be persuaded. And they're going to have to vote not only for the president, but for their representatives who are going to do the work. Because as Charlie and Norm are pointing out, the Republican Senate right now is asleep under Donald Trump's sofa.
Mm. Charlie Sykes, just to turn back to something that Norm said, when he said he wanted to just put a blunt point on it, he called the Republican Party more of a cult than a party. What do you think?
Norm and I have talked about this before, and as reluctant as I am to agree with that, I don't. Yes, it does feel like that. Much of the president's support is cult-like. There's also just a part of this party that is purely transactional, mm-hmm. which is we'll go along with this. We won't make trouble about it because we want certain things. And then there's a large portion that is just simply, you know, keeping their head down because they don't want to be attacked on Twitter. They're afraid of the Republican base. But you do have a large portion of this party that will turn on a dime, will abandon any principle, any standard, as long as it serves the Orange God King. And I don't know how else you describe that other than cult-like.
Now, I wanted to ask you that because not out of any sense of glee at all, but out of a sense of heartbreak, because if indeed what we're talking about is a profound mindset shift in a once great party and the leaders of a once great party, as all of you have said, changing minds takes time. You know, like breaking those norms is quick, but reestablishing new norms takes time. So are we looking, Charlie, at years, decades, I don't know, of nothing short of internal reform to the Republican Party? And if so, as a necessity, and if so, how is that going to happen?
Well, I don't think we have time to go through that in depth. And the answer is we just don't know. But it's going to take a very, very long time. This infection is not going to go away when Donald Trump leaves the scene. And yes, it is a profound shift in this party. And let's be honest about it. Donald Trump was responsible for a lot of it, but he's also just a symptom. This dysfunction was obviously a pre-existing condition, which is going to make it that much harder. And you asked a really profound question, a really troubling question is, you know, does the American public really care? I mean, is there a portion of the American public that looks at the corruption, looks at the lies and goes, yeah, we're okay with that? I hope the answer is no. But I do think that we need to understand that there is a huge portion of the Republican base that simply does not know about what we're talking about. They live in an alternative reality silo with different news, different personalities, and they may not know many of this stuff. But what's most troubling are the ones that do, and because of tribal loyalty, are willing to go along with it. And that's not easily repaired.
Or, Norm, there's the belief that it's a victimless form of corruption.
Yeah, there's some of that. I do think, you know, in the past when we've had public outrage over scandal, it's because there's one scandal that gets reported day after day after day, and ultimately it penetrates even the consciousness of people who pay little attention to politics, and they realize this is something that's profoundly wrong. When you have three or four scandals a day that get passing mention in the news, many of which don't even make the front pages, and you have no oversight done, you get a wash of scandals that deadens people to the reality of it. That's certainly a part of it. But I think it's also even more than that, the failure of the Republicans in the Senate to do oversight, not just on the scandals, but on the maladministration and the malfeasance inside government. The failures now with the response to the pandemic that have resulted because of bad governance and decisions made perniciously in thousands of unnecessary deaths. What was done with private prisons going in and dealing with asylum seekers and with child separation? Virtually no oversight. The kind of corruption that we have in the student loan program, the private university program, the way in which they've handled the entire immigration issue. Across the board, we have seen almost no oversight. The see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil element here has done such a disservice to the country, but it's also destroyed a proud party, and it's a tragedy for all of us.
Well, Joel Brenner, we've got about a minute left to go, and I'm thinking that yesterday, Christy Grimm, until recently was serving as acting inspector general at HHS, she testified before a House Oversight Committee. The House Oversight Committee, and talked about the fact that the Office of Inspectors General follow the facts wherever they lead, that they are impartial in what they do. Can we continue to have confidence in that core mission in these various offices in the federal government?
I think we can have confidence in the career people who are fulfilling these offices. I think they believe in what they're doing. There really is a culture of conscientiousness. The question is whether these offices could survive another 4 years of this president. He's done a great deal of damage to the government in ways that Charlie and Norm have really articulated beautifully. Some of that damage will be undone. Another 4 years of this, I don't know. And we haven't even begun to talk about the place of the United States in the world and the damage this president has done to that.
Well, Joel Brenner served as the Inspector General for the National Security Agency between 2002 to 2006. Joel, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and author of many books, including The Broken Branch. Norm, it was great to have you back. Thank you.
Great to be there, too.
And Charlie Sykes, editor-in-chief of The Bulwark. Charlie, it was great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.